This week is Parshas Emor, and we've been touching on some of the themes that the Rebbe discussed in the talks that the Rebbe gave throughout the year, Tavshin on Aleph and Tavshin on Beis, which ran through parts of 1991 and 1992, 9 years ago. And the issues that the Rebbe discussed relating to the topic of Mashiach, which that was the complete emphasis at that time, and following the order of the portion of the week as it was spoken at that time. At that time, in Parshas Emor, the Rebbe discussed, continued what he had been discussing the previous week, which we discussed last week, the concept that Geula, the Hebrew word for redemption, Geula, which has become the primary term to refer to redemption, even though we find in the Torah other terms for redemption, the main term that has come to, the generic term that has come to refer to redemption, and particularly the ultimate redemption, is the word Geula. And the Rebbe explains that the significance of the word Geula is that it is made up of the letters of the word Geula, which means exile, in addition to which there is the letter Aleph. The letter Aleph representing Alufei Shel Olam. The word Aluf means like a general or a leader, that the Aleph represents the Eibishter, God, who is the leader of the world. And the Rebbe explained that why is this so? One would think that redemption means to get away from exile. So how is it that the word for redemption actually includes in it the word for exile with an addition of the letter Aleph? So the Rebbe explains that our function in exile is not to run away from exile, is not to leave all our affairs behind and start a whole new life, but rather the ultimate purpose is to take all of those things in which people were involved in throughout their sojourn in exile, to elevate all of those things and to introduce a godly element into all of the matters that people are involved with in exile, thereby bringing godliness into the world as we know it. And the Rebbe quoted, the Rambam says that you shouldn't think that the world is going to change, that when Mashiach comes, the world will continue to conduct itself in the normal fashion. The changes will be primarily spiritual. That people will no longer be wars and conflicts, and people will be free to engage in the study of Torah and performance of mitzvahs, and so on. However, the Rebbe said, this only explains the aspect of redemption which deals with that particular era, the first initial era after the revelation of Mashiach. But we know that later on there will be tremendous transformative events which will actually change the nature of the world as we know it. And in fact, it's one of the basic tenets of belief is that one day there will be the resurrection of the dead. Obviously, the dead being resurrected and people enjoying eternal life is certainly something which is out of the ordinary and cannot be described as the world continuing in its old normal fashion. So obviously there's a later period in which we will see far greater revelations. And the question is, and yet we still refer to redemption in its entirety, including all of the later developments, with the generic title of Geula. And certainly that later period is going away from the conditions and situation of exile rather than simply elevating them. So the Rebbe went on to explain that the significance of the word Geula as it relates to those things which go beyond the nature, the natural order, those revelations which will follow, which will be completely beyond nature. So the Rebbe said that the significance of the word Geula being made up of Geula, which means exile, and the Aleph, which represents the Eibushta, is that the way we bring about the revelation is through our efforts in Golus, through our efforts in exile, through the fact that we work in exile. This is what brings about the revelation of the Aleph. So the understanding of the word Geula as it relates to these future developments is that it is through our efforts in Geula, through our efforts in exile, that we bring about the revelation of these greater revelations of godliness as represented by the letter Aleph. In Parshas Emor, the Rebbe continues to follow that theme, and interestingly enough, doesn't even deal with the portion of the week directly. And the Rebbe says that to illustrate this concept, that the word Geula represents two aspects. One is the elevation of all of the exile itself, introducing an element of divinity into the natural order. And then the second aspect, which is a revelation of godliness which goes beyond nature, but is accomplished through our efforts. The Rebbe says, as an illustration of this, is the first redemption, the first time we find the concept of Geula in our history, which is Geulas Mitzrayim, the redemption from Egypt. One of the things that we find at the end of the exile in Egypt, when the Jewish people were about to leave, they were asked to go to their Egyptian neighbors and to borrow gold and silver vessels and clothing. And it says that they actually did so. And even beyond that, it says that what the Egyptians brought to the sea was even greater than what the Jews took from Egypt. And they were able to basically clean out the land of Egypt, in the words of our sages, a waterway without any fish. In other words, like a net totally sweeps out, it grabs all the fish at once. When a wave pushes the fish through into the net, it totally cleaned out the land of Egypt. But this represents the elevation of all the aspects of the exile. That it's not enough that they just left Egypt. The point of being in exile was not just that it was a condition and a situation which they had to get away from, but actually they took with them all of the material wealth of Egypt, which represents elevating all the aspects of the physical world within the exile. The question is, however, that we find another development in that process, which our sages tell us that the Egyptians didn't wait until the Jews asked them for things, but the Egyptians were forcing the Jews to take things from them. They were forcing them to borrow gold and silver vessels and clothing. So the question is, after all of this, after the 10 plagues and all of the suffering that the Egyptians were put through, obviously they were not interested in seeing the Jews go. Why is it that as part of the redemption from Egypt, it was necessary that the Egyptians themselves participate, initiate, and go and insist that Jews borrow things that they didn't even ask for? So that explains that this represents the other aspect of Geula, the idea that a transformation which transcends the natural order, but which was a result of our efforts, the result of our avodah, of our work in exile. So we didn't even have to go through the means of actually asking and approaching the Egyptians to borrow, but that they themselves went and pushed and insisted that the Jewish people borrow from them. However, the question remains that the fact is that besides for elevating everything in the land of Egypt, and besides for actually bringing about a supernatural transformation, revelation, through the fact that the Egyptians themselves came to recognize and came to know God, and therefore they themselves initiated in giving us the things that we needed in order to take with us, the question is that the main events actually seem to take place after they already left. The main events connected to the redemption from Egypt actually took place after they left. You have the splitting of the city. First of all, you have the fact, even within Egypt itself, you have that it says in the Haggadah, Nigla Leia Melech Malcha Amlochem HaKadosh Baruch Hu B'Chvedu V'Atzmi U'Gol, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the Eivishter himself in all his glory revealed himself upon and to the Jewish people and redeemed them. This was a revelation that was exclusively to the Jewish people. It had nothing to do with the impact on the Egyptians. It had nothing to do with a transformation of the exile. This was something that was exclusively reserved for the Jewish people. Only they actually experienced this revelation. And then you have the further revelations which actually took place after they left. You have the revelation at the splitting of the sea and the revelation at the giving of the Torah, which was the ultimate purpose of going out of Egypt. So you have these revelations which had nothing to do with the exile, had nothing to do with transforming the exile. And yet, we still say that the word Geula means the introduction of the letter Aleph into the exile. So even though we explain that the way that even these higher revelations are brought about through our efforts within exile, but it still doesn't fully explain why the makeup of the word Geula is that the Aleph itself is introduced into the Geula, into the exile. When you're talking about revelations which seem to be totally removed from and had no direct connection to the exile, because it was after they already cleaned out Egypt, it was after they already had left, and had nothing to do with the Egyptians, had nothing to do with their state and experience within exile. But that explains that the letter Aleph actually has a number of meanings. The letter Aleph, as we said earlier, represents Alufa Shel Olam, the master of the world, the leader of the world. There's another meaning for the word Aleph. The word Aleph has a meaning which indicates the idea of learning, of study, teaching. As it says in the Pasuk in Iyov, it says, E'alofcha chachma, e'alofcha bina. I will teach you wisdom, I will teach you understanding. That the word Aleph has a meaning which signifies the concept of learning. But we find that the letter Aleph has even yet another meaning. In the Zohar we find on the verse in Yeshaya which says, Ata Asisa Pela, you have made wonders, that the Zohar says, Ata Asisa Aleph. He takes the word Pela, rearranges the letters, Pei Lamed Aleph, to spell out the word Aleph, the letter Aleph. That you have made, Ata Asisa Pela, that you have made the Aleph. So we see that on a deeper level, the letter Aleph represents a Pella, something which is wondrous, something which is amazing, something which is beyond our understanding. As we know, as it says in the Mishnah, the Muflamimcha al that something which is beyond you, you should not try to seek out, you should not try to pursue. So the word Pella represents something which is a wondrous and amazing thing, which is actually beyond our understanding. And all of these are represented by the letter Aleph. The Rebbe explains that the truth is that this corresponds to three levels of godliness that ultimately have to be revealed in the world. The first meaning of the word Aleph, which we said means Aluf, the leader, Aluf Shalalim, the leader of the world, this represents the aspect of godliness which energizes and sustains the world. Everybody knows and understands that what keeps the world going is energy. There's a life force which sustains the world. That is not something which anybody questions. The question is, what is the nature of that life force? The truth is that the nature of that life force is divinity. The nature of that life force is godliness. But the way in which the Eivishter created the world is that the fact that that life force is of a godly nature is concealed. So even though everyone and anyone can see and observe for themselves that there is a life force that is that gives the world its life, that gives the world its energy, but what's not readily perceived is the fact that that life force is of a godly nature. So someone or something is keeping the world going. The question is, what and who? What and who is not obvious, and in fact, who it really is, the fact that it is God who is sustaining the world, is completely concealed. Our job, the life force is already there. What's concealed, what's hidden is the origins of that life force. Our job is to reveal the origins of that life force, to reveal the fact that what keeps the world going, the existence of the world, is godliness. That is our job, of revealing godliness within the world. And that was the first understanding of the word Geula, as we explained, that revealing godliness within the world, bringing the Aleph into the Geula, within the exile, within the constraints and limitations of the natural order, means revealing how each and everything in creation is actually a godly existence. How do we do that? The way we do that is by interacting with the world, by using everything that exists in the world, and using it for a godly purpose. By using the objects, by using the physicality, the materials that we encounter in our daily life, that are in the world, by using them and introducing into them a godly purpose and a godly mission, so we reveal that the true existence of that item, of that object, and ultimately of the entire world, is godliness. However, that is the aspect of godliness in which God limits himself, so to speak, constricts himself, and expresses himself in a finite way into a finite world. However, there is an aspect of godliness which is higher than this. There's an aspect of godliness which corresponds to Aleph, which means learning. Learning is something that is done with the intellect. What is the difference between the intellect and the emotion? The primary difference between the intellect and the emotions is that the intellect functions completely internal. What I use my mind for is for me. My mind helps me understand the world around me. It can even help me understand abstract concepts. But my mind is how I relate things to me. It relates to me. I could choose to share the ideas that I develop in my mind, but ultimately my mind relates to myself. My emotions, on the other hand, are how I relate to others. my emotions are how I relate to others, are my feelings about others, my interactions with others, whether it's in a way of kindness or in a way of withholding of kindness or in a way of mercy. Emotions represent the internal processes with which I relate to and interact with others. So similarly, within the divine, within the chain of divinity, the Eivishter created aspects of himself which relate to the world and its existence. A finite world with a finite existence. But he also created aspects which relate to himself. So the intellectual aspects of godliness, as we know that in the 10 spheros, there are Chachma, Bina, and Das are the intellectual faculties. Chesed, Gvura, Tiferes, and so on are the emotional faculties. So when God created the world, he created the world in 7 days. He invested in the world, which correspond to the 7 emotional faculties. The finite aspect of godliness that is invested into the world originates in the divine emotion. However, the divine intellect, which is the source of the emotion, which is the source of creation, remains above and removed from creation. Because it is, so to speak, God as he relates to himself. And God as he relates to himself is beyond, is not limited, is not finite, and cannot be invested into our limited world. So there is God as emotion are the internal processes with which we relate to other people, our feelings about other people, how we relate outside of ourselves. The intellect is completely internal. Intellect is how I relate to things for myself. So similarly, in the process of creation, there's the aspect of divinity which God invested into the world, relating to the world, so to speak. And there's the aspects of godliness which remain higher, above, and removed from the world. These aspects correspond to the aspect, to the letter Aleph, as it means, Elofcha Chachma, Elofcha Bina, Milashin, that means to learn. But there's a third aspect of godliness, which is even higher than infinite godliness, which is even higher than the aspect of godliness which transcends the world. There is God as he is unto himself. The spheres are ultimately, even the intellect ultimately serves the purpose, it still relates to things outside of oneself. But instead of being the source of how I relate outside of myself, it's how I relate to things outside of myself to me. It's not the emotions are how I relate outside of myself to others. The intellect is how I relate things, realities outside of myself to me. Within God himself, where there is no outside existence. So the existence of intellectual faculties are just as irrelevant as the existence of emotional faculties. Because ultimately the intellect also has to relate to things outside of oneself. So until God decided to create a process of creation, there did not exist any faculties, not intellectual, not emotional. So the truth is that God himself cannot be ascribed any faculties, not intellectual faculties or emotional faculties. Because God himself ultimately transcends both intellect and emotions. And both the intellect and emotions are something which he brought into existence. So God himself is on the level of Aleph Isis Pella. Pella means something which is beyond our comprehension, something which is beyond our understanding, something which is beyond intellect. But the truth is that this third level can also be understood within the context of the spheres. Within the context of the spheres, because within intellect itself, there are actually two levels. There is intellect as I understand and perceive realities outside of me. That is true. But there is the intellect as I relate entirely to myself. Not as I relate to things which are outside of me and how do I understand them. But the intellect, there's a level of intellect which is not in terms, has nothing to do with how I relate to it altogether. It has nothing to do with relating. There is perceiving objective reality and nothing to do with how that reality does or does not relate to it. The perception of objective reality, irregardless of how it relates to me or affects me, that is the function of the inner dimension of the intellect. And therefore, that could be said to transcend the intellect as well. So we can break it down within the spheres itself to the emotions, the intellect that relates to the emotion, you know, the part of the intellect that sees, that tries to understand things in terms of how they relate to me. Is it good for me? Is it bad for me? Do I like it? Should I like it? Shouldn't I like it? And this is, these decisions come about through having an understanding of those things outside of yourself, but it's how they relate to you. And then there's the aspect of the intellect which has nothing to do with how I relate or how I don't relate. It has nothing to do with is it good for me, is it not good for me. It has nothing to do with should I like it or shouldn't I like it. It is a tool through which I can perceive objective reality, irregardless of how it does or does not affect. Nothing to do with me. Just perceiving objective reality as it is. This corresponds to that aspect of godliness which is the ultimate objective reality and has no subjective qualities because it doesn't relate outside of itself because nothing exists outside of itself. So the Rebbe says our job in exile is to bring the revelation of the Aleph into the exile includes all three levels of Aleph as we just explained. The godliness that's invested in creation, Aleph as it refers to, as it relates to the word Aleph, leader of the world. Our job is to reveal the Aleph as it represents the godliness which transcends nature. Aleph, Milachin, which means learning, which relates to the intellect. And our job is to reveal the Aleph, the revelation of godliness, which is true infinity, which is true objective reality and the only true reality, and that which is God Himself, and that corresponds to the letter Aleph as it represents the word Pella, as it represents that which is beyond comprehension, at least in the sense of comprehension as personalized subjective comprehension, but occupies objective reality. The Rebbe says, how do we do it? We understand how we reveal godliness within the world, the aspect of godliness that's invested into the world that we understand. The way that we do it is we do it through interacting with the world, through utilizing everything that we encounter in the world, every situation, every material object, and utilizing it to a divine end, to a divine purpose. So we reveal that the life force that's invested into the world is of a divine nature. We reveal the godliness that's within the world. The question is, how is it that we're supposed to reveal the godliness which is higher than the world, which transcends the world? And how are we supposed to reveal the ultimate objective reality of godliness as it is the only true existence? So the Rebbe says the means with which we do this is through Torah. And Torah itself has two dimensions to it. As we said, that the higher revelation of godliness, the aspect of godliness which is higher than the world, corresponds to the letter Aleph as it has the meaning of learning. The way God invested himself into this world, the way God, to put it differently, the way God gave us access to that aspect of godliness which transcends the world is through Torah. How is that? Because Torah is that which defines reality. Many people perceive Torah as something which relates to a pre-existing reality. But the fact is, and the Torah tells you how to function and behave within that reality. But the fact is that the Torah itself defines reality. The Torah itself, as our sages tell us, that there are situations where nature itself has to adjust to the reality of Torah. And the Torah, as the Zohar says, that God looked into the Torah and created the world. And the Torah is compared to the blueprints of creation. Very much like the relationship between the intellect and the emotions. That how does a person decide how to respond, what to feel, how to respond to others, based on their understanding of the situation. First, they understand, they observe, they study a situation. They understand it. Based on that understanding, they respond. So similarly, based on the blueprints outlined within Torah, based on that, God created the world. So the Torah is where God invested the intellectual faculties that transcend creation. The divine intellect which transcends creation is invested into Torah. When we learn Torah, and we bring the Torah down into our finite physical intellect, when we bring the Torah down into our finite physical intellects, what we're doing is we're bringing that transcendent aspect of godliness down into the finite existence, the finite creation. We're bringing godliness into the world. This is the internal process through the Jewish people that takes place within each and every Jew, which brings this higher level of godliness down into the world. How do we bring the ultimate level of godliness into the world? God himself. Aleph, Isis, Pella. How do we go about doing that? The truth is there's a deeper dimension of Torah. There's a deeper dimension of Torah in which God invested his very essence. A dimension of Torah which discusses realities that have nothing to do with our lives. The Torah, the wisdom that's contained within the Torah, within the revealed portion of the Torah, deals with issues that affect our everyday lives. It's a higher perception. It forces us to transcend our everyday issues and look at things from a higher perspective, from a divine perspective. Pnimius HaTorah, the inner dimension of the Torah, deals with realities that have nothing to do with our lives. Sure, there are things that we could take and derive from these teachings which do relate to our everyday life. But ultimately, the objective reality being described in these teachings is ultimately a reality which does not relate to our existence. Because that ultimate reality is that we don't have an existence outside of God. There is nothing to relate to outside of God. There is, on the ultimate level, there is no relationship and separation between us and God, because the ultimate truth is that God is everything and everything is God. On that level of perception of the ultimate, true, objective reality, there is no room for relationships. It's not how does God relate to me, it's not how do I relate to God, it's not how does God relate to the world, or how do I relate to the world. There is nothing except the true reality that nothing else exists except God. So by learning Pnimius HaTorah, and yet we bring this reality, we bring this perception of reality into our own, once again, into our finite, limited minds of flesh and blood. Finite, limited human beings of flesh and blood have the capacity to bring this perception of reality through Pnimius HaTorah into their finite little existence. So that is the means through which we bring down the revelation of the true reality of Aleph Esius Pella, the ultimate revelation of God Himself, into the limitations and constraints of Gaila, of exile, and reveal that Aleph within the exile itself. And in fact, we find that the Alter Rebbe says that the true purpose of the exile in Egypt was so that the Jews be put through a refinement process in preparation for the giving of the Torah. Because the Torah is, as we just explained, a revelation that's higher than creation. So how can a limited finite being be a vessel for such a revelation? So he has to go through a refinement process which enables him to extend beyond his natural limitations and be a suitable vessel for the revelation of Torah. Torah being that reality which is higher than creation. So it's not enough to elevate everything in Egypt. The ultimate purpose of going into Egypt is not just to elevate everything that exists within Mitzrayim, elevate by cleaning it out and taking all the gold and silver and so on. But actually, it's through that process that we receive the revelation of Torah. The Alter Rebbe says, the ultimate purpose of this exile, which is almost 10 times longer than the exile in Egypt, the ultimate purpose of this exile is in order to prepare ourselves and become vessels for the revelation of Pnimius HaTech. Because if 210 years is enough in order to be refined enough to receive the revelation of the revealed aspect of Torah, the concealed aspects of Torah, that which express God's true reality, the true objective reality of God as He exists unto Himself, that is something which requires a much longer refinement process in order to be suitable vessels for that revelation. But ultimately we see that it is the exile process itself. It is the exile process itself that enables these revelations. But not only does it enable these revelations, but as we started with, but actually ultimately these revelations have to come down. The process through which we do it is by bringing these revelations themselves down into the world, into the finite reality, into the Gaila, into the exile. When we study Torah, when we study Pnimius HaTorah, that in itself, the bringing the Aleph into the Gaila is itself the process through which we merit these ultimate revelations. The Rebbe says, if that's true about redemption, that the ultimate redemption represents the complete revelation of the godliness invested into creation, the godliness which transcends creation, and the revelation of God Himself. And the way that this is brought about is through the process of revealing godliness within creation by utilizing the material world for introducing a godly purpose into everything one does in this world. And through the study of Torah, and ultimately through the study of the deeper dimension of Torah. So the Rebbe says, if that's the case, then these three aspects must exist by Mashiach himself. The Rebbe says, where do we find these three aspects in existence by Mashiach himself? So the Rebbe explains that we find by Mashiach that first of all, says that he's involved in the study of Torah and the performance of mitzvahs. And one of the descriptions of Mashiach is that his primary involvement is the study of Torah and the performance of mitzvahs. And ultimately, Mashiach is going to usher in an era where the involvement of every person will be only to pursue the knowledge of God. And he is the one that will teach everyone. So in Mashiach himself, we find that Mashiach himself is involved with elevating the world, teaching of Torah, bringing Torah into the world, and the teaching of Pnimius HaTorah. What's very interesting is that we don't find by the Friedrich Rebbe, even by the Rebbe Rashab, but especially by the Friedrich Rebbe, we find that he went out of his way to only teach Chassidus. And anything not directly relating to Chassidus, he didn't teach or publicize any writings. Even from the Rebbe Rashab, we have a handful of writings. From the previous Rebbe, from the Friedrich Rebbe, we have nothing. In fact, the Rebbe once said over that there was a mimer, the Hasidic discourse of the Friedrich Rebbe, in which the Friedrich Rebbe quoted many things from Nigla and showed how they could be explained according to Hasidus. And when they wrote it up, and when he gave out the mimer in writing, he took out all the Nigla and only left in the Chassidus. So the Rebbe said that he went into his father-in-law and said, okay, I understand that, you know, you don't show, and whatever reason you have, you don't show in public your knowledge of Nigla. But you did it already. When you said the discourse in public, you said it already. So how come now that you put it out in writing, now you're leaving it out? So the Friedrich Rebbe answered what he had answered on other occasions. He said, my father told me that my job is to spread the teachings of Chassidus. And anything else is not my job. Since he told me that's my job, if I would do anything else besides spread the teachings of Chassidus, then that's not my job. By the Rebbe, on the other hand, we find, as never before, and even the Alter Rebbe and the Tzemach Tzedek, we do have more writings from in Nigla. Basically, the Alter Rebbe wrote Psak Halacha. This is what you have to do. This is what you have to do. Whether you understand it or not, he gives the reasons, but he gives a Psak, a final decision. This is what you have to do. Even the Tzemach Tzedek, most of the writings of the Tzemach Tzedek also deal directly, strictly with halachic issues, and focus primarily on, and relate primarily to scholarly people. Only by the Rebbe do we find that the Rebbe should actually teach Nigla. Teach Nigla, in other words, bring down ideas and concepts and discuss issues in Nigla and bring it down to the level that everyone and anyone could understand. And at the same time, teach the highest levels of Chassidus as well, and bring it down to the level that any and every person could understand. So the Rebbe, what's the first thing that you start with a child in Nigla? It's Chumash and Rashi. Chumash and Rashi is the most basic in the revealed Torah that we learned. What's the most basic? The most basic is Chumash and Rashi. The Rebbe, we find that the Rebbe was involved in teaching Chumash and Rashi. The Rebbe would sit up in public and teach us Chumash and Rashi. And at the same time, obviously the Rebbe spoke many sukkahs which went beyond Chumash and Rashi. And at the same time, be teaching the deepest and highest levels of Chassidus, levels discussing aspects of godliness which in earlier generations were considered too high to discuss publicly. And the Rebbe at the same time brought those down to us as well. But that's this idea that the Rebbe says that within Mashiach himself is contained on all three of these aspects. On the one hand, the tremendous involvement with the world, elevating and refining the physical world. On the other hand, and in addition to that, the involvement of Torah study, but bringing the Torah down, taking the divine wisdom of the Torah and bringing it down so that the human intellect can grasp and understand and appreciate it as well. And the ultimate level is to take the teachings of Chassidus, which define God's reality, and also bring them down into the limitations of the finite, of the most finite of human intellects, that even a child, the only person that ever spoke Chassidus to little children, is that ever took Chassidus, that ever took the highest concepts of Chassidus and brought them down to the level that he actually could speak and address little children. And the Rebbe says so too, each and every one of us has a spark of Mashiach within ourselves. So here again we see, the reason why I'm showing these examples are to realize that these things that the Rebbe teach us are not just concepts. They're not just, we hear Aleph, Aleph, Chachma, Pella, it all sounds very mystical, and it all sounds very wondrous. And sometimes we look at these things and we can't really relate to them. We don't see how, what does it have to do with the practical reality as we know it? But the fact is, the way that Eva constructs the Sikha, he says that these three aspects have to exist within Mashiach himself. How you do it? What does it mean? What it means to be involved in worldly matters and elevate worldly matters and worldly affairs? What it means to delve into and to throw oneself into the study of Torah in such a way and bring it down to the most basic level, bring down the higher reality of Torah into our finite understanding, and ultimately how to take and process the highest and deepest teachings of Chassidus and bring it down into our own limited understanding, into those parts of us which are chutzah, and ultimately to bring it outside, even to those whose backgrounds and knowledge and skills are even more limited. And it's through this process that by expressing these three realities into our life, we bring about the revelation of the Aleph in the Gaila, and this is what each and every one of us has to contribute in the process of bringing about the full and complete redemption immediately now.